Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Mike down here in Arizona land. Today is the 20th of August, 2018. It's a Monday. You're tuned in to Liberty Tree Radio, and it's about 2 minutes or so after 8. Just going to run with it here. Maybe the bumper music will come in, but if it doesn't, we've already started our broadcast today. Thanks for taking the time to tune in. And thank you for helping support Liberty Tree Radio. You know, it's past the half of the year mark. We have a drive to try to get some funds collected by the end of the year to pay next year's bill. It's important that that gets done and then can cut the bill in half by paying it in full ahead of time. Have about 8 or 10 border items. As always, we send this broadcast out for Lily Grace Antoinette. My email address is altabeeb762@hotmail.com. altabeeb762@hotmail.com. Also, a friend of mine, a Vietnam veteran, Rainey, as that's his real name, will be on the Micro Effect on Thursday at this time. So at 8 a.m. Arizona time, start the broadcast and bring Rainey up. Not exactly sure of how long it'll be, 10 minutes, half an hour, both hours. I don't know. I offered him as much time as he wanted. He was in intelligence and counterintelligence in Vietnam, stationed in Pleiku, and he was kind of towards the bottom of it. There were a lot of officers and NCOs in their shop, and sometimes because he was down towards the bottom of the pecking order that got stuck with some mundane task, going out to some of the outerlying posts and making sure that the thermite grenade was attached on top of the file cabinet in case the deal got overrun and other things. But he has also collected information and to try to counter the VCI infrastructure on collecting information on troop strengths and movements and stuff. So I get to have his perspective on what he saw and did. To try to get some of these other people that some of them are a little reluctant, and we'll see. I have quite a few of them. One's a helicopter pilot in the first Air Cav. One of them, was a medic. Rainey is intelligence. Another one was a infantry commander in the 2nd of the 7th, Gary Owens. And what else? A pretty good assortment. Another one was a special forces, retired as a major, and recondo, ranger, green beret, in the world's toughest school. In the past, we've been discussing about General Grievous on guerrilla war in Cyprus. And last week,
hey, Mike.
We had... Yes.
I hate to interrupt. We are having a problem with the station this morning. It's having to do with Skype. They've taken away my number pad, so I can't access the conference code number. I'm trying to find a workaround for it right now. You are being archived on the conference line if you want to continue this hour here, or if you want to wait until I get this fixed. I'm going to leave it up to you.
No, I'll just keep running it. That would be fine.
Okay, I don't have a way to play music or anything to you right now, so just play out the hour here. I'm working on the problem. When I get it fixed, I will let you know, all right?
Sounds like a plan.
Okay.
Very good.
Hey, Mike.
Jim, good morning.
Good morning, man. I just dialed in. Seems there's technical difficulty. I don't know what it is, though.
Yeah, Edward just said that there was... something with Skype, there's no keypad, so he can't enter in his access code and that, but we're on the conference line, and we decided just to keep running. He's working on it, and also because of that part and the internet aspect of it, so there won't be any bumper music. I've not, other than just making my general announcements of the date and the rainy interview and my email address, just kind of getting everything running right now. I'm going to discuss about General Grievous on guerrilla war in Cyprus, kind of continue our block of instruction there.
All good. Let me get on the side here. All right.
Okay. Very good then.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your concern. As we had ran up here the other day, when we were discussing about General Grievous and Cyprus, the island of Cyprus in the Mediterranean, the Britain, London, had a governor there, Sir Robert Armitage, and they decided to replace him. The replacement came in as a much decorated field marshal, Sir John Harding. He's an outstanding British general of World War II who had just relinquished the post of chief of the Imperial General Staff. Now,
hey, Mike, I hate to interrupt you again. You are back up on here. Fix the problem. I don't know what happened to it on there. It just took it away, and I logged out, logged back in, and came back. So it's fine.
Came back.
Uh-huh.
It's a miracle.
All right.
I can see.
Yeah.
Very good. Thank you.
All right.
Okay. Good. Well, I guess now we're flying. Okay, so anyway, we were discussing about the replacement of Sir Robert Armitage as the governor in Cyprus, and because he wasn't getting any results, and most likely it wasn't because of a lack of effort. So London decided to replace him with Field Marshal Sir John Harding, British general of World War II, and he had just relinquished the post of chief of the Imperial General Staff. Now, Grievous writes that he was, in fact, the leading British soldier of his day, and no higher compliment could have been paid us than to send against our tiny forces a man with so great a reputation and so brilliant a career, end quote. Now, Harding, as it developed, was to have no better success against the EOKA than had his predecessor. And the appointment of a military man to replace the civilian governor made it clear that Downing Street intended to stamp out EOKA by main force rather than to continue a police action. But the trouble, as is usually the case when opposing guerrillas, and even more so when fighting terrorists, was that there was nothing substantial against which to apply the force. And as Grievous explains, the British answer to our methods was to flood the island with troops. It was the wrong answer. And numbers have little meaning in guerrilla warfare. From the guerrilla's point of view, it is positively dangerous to increase the size of groups beyond a certain point. I call this the saturation point. It is determined by the nature of the terrain, the skill of the fighters, their requirements in food and supplies, the tactics employed, and the need to keep down casualties. And any given area can usefully absorb a certain amount of men. In mountainous country, where peaks and ravines are dead ground, the figure is only a fraction of the numbers required elsewhere. I myself, when I joined the Andartes in the mountains, always felt uneasy if there were more than a half a dozen of us together. Even in the plains, the saturation point is lower than one might suppose. For example, to use more than five or six men in a village attack would serve no purpose. For the more numerous the attackers, the more difficult it is for them to escape after the action. And on the same principle, villages where we were strong, pretending inertia on my orders until it was appropriate for them to strike. Now, while others, where our forces were weaker, continue an attack repeatedly, simply to deceive the enemy. if this led to arrest, even of a whole group. It was not important, for there was always a complete reserve group waiting to fill their positions. And thus, I never disclosed my full strength to the enemy, but after each sudden eruption of violence left an empty battlefield, and when the British tried to strike back, they found nothing to strike at. And this was the secret of my success throughout 4 years of hard fighting, and my principles did not change when Harding came on the scene, end quote. Now, it's well to remember that Grievous is talking about a campaign based primarily on terrorism and sabotage, fought on a small island affording little space for maneuver, and aimed at political rather than military effect. He's not trying to build self-sustaining guerrilla base areas or to reach the ultimate guerrilla goal, impossible on Cyprus, of an equalization of military force. In terms of Cyprus, small guerrilla units could be treated as expendable. They were expendable in precisely the way that terrorists are expendable, who do not seek to build a military force, but rather to produce political and psychological effects, often by sacrificing themselves. Now, Grievous clearly used his urban and rural groups in interaction. When he wished to conduct campaigns in the countryside, he raised big political demonstrations in the town that kept the troops occupied there on riot duty, while the guerrilla groups made lightning attacks on rural objectives. When he was planning a new drive in the cities, he created diversions in the countryside that brought the troops out in intensive ratissages, R-A-T-I-S-S-A-G-E-S. He, again, quoting from Grievous, "My resources were meager, and I could not hope to win a military victory," he writes. "It was rather a question of raising a force and keeping it in being, no matter what the enemy did to destroy it. This and more was achieved in the first 6 months," end quote. Now, on his arrival in Nicosia, Harding made a cursory attempt to negotiate with Archbishop Makarios. And when the negotiations broke down within a few days, Grievous ordered a full-scale EOKA offensive. New attacks were launched against village police stations in an effort to draw out the army. EOKA men raided the Mitsercero mine and escaped with 1,500 sticks of dynamite, 600 detonators, and 3,000 yards of fuse. Another raiding party invaded the military warehouse in Famagusta Harbor, bound and gagged the watchmen, and drove off with a truckload of British arms, Bren guns, Stens, mortars, and bazookas. A political agitation was intensified, and the British worsened the situation for themselves by ill-advised attempts to prevent public demonstrations. The timing of the announcement that Michael Coraolis, the first hero of the revolution, had been sentenced to death could not have been worse. The announcement came on October 28, a national holiday marking the refusal of Greece to surrender to the Axis powers in 1940. Harding banned any sort of public demonstration. Grievous responded by calling on Cypriots to defy the ban, and a series of bloody clashes resulted. Troops opened fire on a riotous crowd, wounding three men, and there were more than 1,000 arrests, jamming the jails of the principal towns, and as a result of the street fighting. With the British forces occupied in towns by demonstrations and sabotage, Grievous ordered an island-wide assault. It began on November 18th when more than 50 bombs were thrown in 30 separate attacks throughout Cyprus. By the end of the week, several hundred attacks had been carried out. The main post office in Nicosia was bombed. The bomb simply dropped in the letterbox, and half the building was destroyed. An 8-pound bomb carried into the Kaikos military encampment outside of Nicosia in a saddlebag of a bicycle blew the roof off of the warrant officers and sergeant mess and killed two sergeants. Army post in Limassol and Larnaca were attacked. Guerrillas in the Carina Range attacked two mines and engaged in firefights with the troops detailed to guard them. Mine company trucks carrying dynamite were ambushed, and near Famagusta, three military vehicles were blasted off the road, causing the army to stop all military movements on the roads at night. Grievous himself led an ambush attack on two army trucks, destroyed one, and then withdrew with his squad to a nearby hilltop and calmly watched as a relief party, which did not appear until 3 hours after the attack, removed the body of the dead soldier from the wreckage. No attempt was made to search the area. A state of emergency was declared throughout the island on November 26th. Police were given extraordinary powers of search and arrest. Strikes were forbidden. The death penalty was imposed for carrying arms, and saboteurs were liable for life imprisonment. British troops, responding to the assassination of their comrades in arms, much as the Black and Tans had done in Ireland, vented their feelings on the civilian population. Soldiers stopped farm trucks on the way to market and dumped their loads of fruit and vegetables out on the road. Search parties invaded private homes, abused the occupants, and destroyed their possessions. Suspects were arrested without warrant and held for weeks or months in detention camps without trial. The security forces set about their work, comments Grievous, in a manner which might have been deliberately designed to drive the population into our arms. And it had that effect. Now, Grievous had gone into the Troodos Mountains to coordinate the guerrilla operations, and on several occasions he narrowly escaped the British commandos combing the area where he happened to be hiding. On one occasion, two British forces totaling 700 men lost in the mist on a mountainside, closed in on each other as the guerrillas escaped, and engaged in a battle with each other that lasted for an hour before they discovered that they were firing on their own troops. And there were more than 50 casualties. On New Year's Day of 1956, Harding broadcast the prediction that the days of EOKA are numbered. The following day, 800 British troops closed in on the woods where Grievous was thought to be, spent the entire day combing an area 2 miles square, and withdrew with three prisoners, Grievous reports. Quote, I was, in fact, a few miles south of the operations area, watching the progress of the search through my binoculars. I was astonished at the unmethodical ways the troops went about their work, end quote. On the 22nd of the month, the EOKA units simultaneously raided every village in Cyprus in an effort to gather up all the several thousand shotguns on the island that were registered with the police. One EOKA man was wounded, and a soldier was killed in the raids, and more than 800 shotguns were seized, and Grievous proceeded to organize special shotgun units. Quote, these were used to harry the British by night, attack army camps, create diversions for major guerrilla attacks, and execute traitors, end quote. By February of 1956, the strength of the army had been increased from 4,000 to some 22,000 men. And EOKA, by this time, had a total of frontline strength of 273 men. Supported by some 750 part-time guerrillas in the villages, armed only with shotguns. And the frontline fighters included 80 men divided into 15 groups in Nicosia, 76 men in Famagusta, and 34 men in Limassol, and that three principal towns of the island. And the numerical odds were vastly in favor of the British, but Grievous considered the army, supported by 5,000 police, a cumbersome body that provided a wealth of targets, new and old, in both towns and mountains. So it proved. How Grievous intensified the campaign of terror and sabotage. The homes of the British senior officers were bombed. British servicemen were shot down in the streets. Bombs were tossed into clubs and taverns frequented by the troops. A servant who belonged to EOKA even succeeded in planting a bomb under the mattress of Sir John Harding's bed. Fortunately for the governor, a sudden change in temperature, so Grievous explains, affected the time pencil, and the bomb did not explode until after it had been discovered and removed. The British seem to have learned little or nothing from their previous experience of terrorism elsewhere. Efforts to intimidate the civilian population that aided EOKA only embittered it. The experiment of imposing collective fines on a Greek community in reprisal against attacks on the British forces. The levies ranged from a few hundred pounds in some small villages to £40,000 in Famagusta and £35,000 in Limassol, and that was abandoned after 6 months as ineffective. Now, stern measures against captured EOK fighters not only failed to act as a deterrent, but created severe political repercussions. When the first of the EOKA gunmen to be executed were hanged for murder in Central Prison Nicosia on May 10, 1956, huge demonstrations in Greece were called in protest. 7 persons were killed in a riot in Athens, and the mayor of that city solemnly hammered to pieces a marble plaque dedicated to Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip before the eyes of the cheering crowd. Even the British press condemned the hangings. No doubt sympathy was felt for the 2 British hostages whom Grievous had executed by EOKA the next day in reprisal for the executions. But the headlines had already been spent on what millions evidently considered a miscarriage of British justice. It is an irony of political warfare and a political fact to be considered and understood that the rules are not the same for both sides. British troops fared no better against the EOKA guerrillas in the countryside than against terrorists in the towns. The troops burned thousands of acres of timber in scattered efforts to flush out guerrilla bands in the mountainside, but few guerrillas were caught, and those were quickly replaced by others. Grievous also writes that Harding tried to strike back at the mountain groups, but lacking any comprehensive plan and failing to grasp our methods, he had few successes. His activities were dependent on spasmodic tips from informers, which were often inexact and unreliable, and led him to concentrate on narrow zones. As many as 50 truckloads of troops would be poured into one small area, which would be searched for days, but nearly always we slipped away before the search began and watched its progress from the neighboring heights, certain that they would not extend the operation beyond its original limits. Now, what should have been done, examining his opponent's problem in retrospect, Grievous writes, Harding persisted in his error. He underrated his enemy on one hand and overweighted his forces on the other. But one does not use a tank to catch field mice. A cat will do the job. The field marshal only hope of finding us was to play cat and mouse, to use tiny, expertly trained groups who could work with cunning and patience and strike rapidly when we least expected. End quote. No such groups were ever developed, and the war continued along the lines with the results that might have been expected, or what Harding was unable to accomplish with 20,000 troops in 1956 could not be accomplished by his successor with twice that many in 1958. 43,000 British soldiers were on Cyprus when the shooting ended. But what were they doing? few could have said. Certainly they were not keeping the peace. Grievous office his record of ELKA activities on October 2, 1958 as giving an idea of the scale of operations at that time. Larnaca, soldier killed by bomb, civilian agent dead by execution squad. Nicosia, bomb thrown into police headquarters from car, casualties unknown. Famagusta, two army trucks ambushed, casualties unknown. Limassol, eight Britons injured by bomb at Acropole Hotel, four soldiers injured by bomb thrown at truck. Plantani, two soldiers killed, two wounded in mined truck. Panagias, Stavros, two soldiers killed, two wounded in ambush. Pyroi, truck ambush, casualties unknown. Misoi, two soldiers killed in ambush of truck. Paiyi, two soldiers killed, two wounded in mine truck. Peristeron, bombs thrown at two army trucks, casualties unknown. The British authorities embittered the struggle, but did little to change its course by involving the Turkish community in the fighting, and the recruitment of Turks into the police and the incitement of latent racial antagonism produced some bloody civilian massacres and a tragic toll of innocent lives on both sides. But divide and rule as the instrument of British policy failed in Cyprus. The eventual political settlement that was reached in the Zurich and London agreements established the Republic of Cyprus under a constitution written by London, Athens, and Ankara, was less than satisfactory to Grievous. He had fought for the independence of the island as a step towards union with Greece, Enosis, and this was denied. But the British could scarcely claim to have won even a partial victory. They had paid a heavy price in money, lives, and prestige during 4 years of futile fighting and had nothing to show for it but a paper compromise that was worse than outright defeat. Where there had been troublesome colonial questions, an explosive international issue was created, and one that remains to date a grave threat to peace in the Mediterranean, a threat not least of all to the British themselves. As to the conflict that led to Zurich, it was round by round a series of clear defeats for the colonial arms and the colonial policies. The British proceeded against EOKA as against a band of ordinary criminals, relying on the methods that had been used to put down an outbreak of banditry and seemingly never to realize what had been perfectly clear to Grievous from the start. Quote, I laughed aloud when I read that General A or Brigadier B had come to Cyprus to put into operation the methods that had won him fame elsewhere. They could not understand that the Cyprus struggle was unique in motive, psychology, and circumstances, and involving not a handful of insurrectionists, but the whole people. End quote. I see we're down at the bottom of the hour. Now, when we come back, we can talk about the failures in the War of the Fleet, Magsaysay and the Hawks in the Philippines, the price of British victory in Malaya, and why the communists lost in Greece. I do have quite a bit of border news. But in the meantime, we're sending this one out to Willie Grace Antoinette. We can join together with the band. We'll be right back. Don't go nowhere.
Call me. Here's a call, I'm coming. I want you to
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Mike down here in Arizona land. Your mind is your primary weapon. Today is the 20th of August, 2018. It's a Monday. You're tuned in to Liberty Tree Radio. It's about 8:35 Arizona time. The first 30 minutes of today's broadcast, we are having a little computer technical difficulty. We got that ironed out within the first 5 minutes or so. And everything seems to be running fine now. I'd like to say thanks for taking the time to listen and to call in. And thank you for helping support Liberty Tree Radio. Hey, hang on 1 second. I have to got a cough. Much better. So anyway, I have a little bit of border news. And as always, we send this and dedicate this out to Lily Grace Antoinette. The call-in number is 712-432-0900, 712-432-0900. And the room number, there's a voice comes in, it says, welcome to the conference line and enter your number, and that would be 957-464, and then the pound sign, 957-464, and then the pound sign. And I guess you could also listen at Liberty Tree Radio. What is that? libertytreeradio.4mg.com. Also, I'd mention, because there's a continuation of our broadcast on the micro effect on Thursday and Friday starting at the same time, 8 a.m. Arizona time. And this Thursday, a friend of mine was in Vietnam in Pleiku, and his job is school-trained intelligence, and his main job there was counterintelligence. So have a little bit of historical perspective from somebody that was actually there. And my email address is althabeb762@hotmail.com. Those first three letters, sometimes they seem to be difficult. I'll spell them phonetically. So that would be Alpha Lima Tango Hotel Alpha Bravo Echo Bravo 762@hotmail.com. Now, some of the principles, as we worked through these, at the beginning we started and we discussed about the word insurgency, Latin, insurge, in the participle, it means to rise up. And then we described the three main components, the political subversives, the guerrillas, and the terrorists, and the jobs that each one does. Now, also, they have the auxiliary and the underground, but they're not necessarily the main force, but they play key roles in the insurgent movement. Also, one of the principles that we point out is that insurgency is a political upheaval and not a military one. And it's in a controlled fashion, and it's well planned out. And because it's both a type and a method of warfare, and it certainly appears to me, and I'm not sure if this is government preservation 101, but you'd be hard-pressed to go to a college or a university and get a degree in military or political science and have any, not very much at least, of what insurgency is. Now, clearly, because of the events that have transpired over about the last 18 years or so, that more and more we hear the term insurgency, but oftentimes it's in a negative connotation, and I'm pretty sure that number one, it's from the news media that wouldn't know the difference between an insurgency and a tennis racket. But they love to sit there in their $1,000 suits and prattle on of making commentary and convincing the American people that an insurgent is some guy named Mohammed with an AK-47 yelling Allah Akbar, and nothing could be further from the truth. So after we started off and discussed about the word, the definition of the word, describe what the each component's job is, and then that's just a surface knowledge to put things into perspective of about what insurgency is. And then we've gone into great detail of about the individual case studies of insurgencies and the parts of about why are some successful and others aren't. Because in the failures in the War of the Fleet, as Magsaysay and the Hucks in the Philippines, the price of the British victory in Malaya, and why the communists lost in Greece. Because Mao's analogy of the gorilla, the swimming like a fish in the sea of the population, is so often repeated because it contains an essential truth. It expresses accurately as well as picturesquely the fundamental principles of guerrilla war. And carry the analogy a step farther and ask what happens when the fish is removed or removes himself from the water. An answer explains better than a treatise the reason for the failure of a few guerrilla movements that have been successfully suppressed. The destruction in 1949 of the Greek communist guerrilla force in the Democratic Army is a prime example. Malaya is another. And the Balahap insurrection in the Philippines is perhaps a third. And all three show what happens when the guerrillas are cut off or deliberately cut themselves off, as the Greek communists did, from the popular contact and support. The Huk movement, which like so many others had its origin in World War II, offers more instruction to the counterinsurgency strategist than do the others, because it exemplifies the successful use of political and social rather than military weapons against the guerrillas. Our credits for the success of the Philippine pacification campaign seems to go largely to the single intelligent politician, the late President Ramon Magsaysay, who became Secretary of the National Defense in 1950 at a time when the Huk appeared almost on the point of invading Manila itself. The Huk, like the Viet Minh in Indochina, the ELAS in Greece, and the Malayan communists, had other insurgents in Axis-held territory throughout the world during World War II and had come into being as a patriotic force, the nationalist guerrilla opposing a foreign invader. And with the blessings and the practical instruction and the material aid of allied powers, specifically of the United States. But revolutionary motivations are complex. The Huks had been fighting for something as well as against something. A wartime slogan had been taken seriously, and with the war over and the Japanese driven from the island, the social aspiration eclipsed even independence, granted conditionally in 1946 as a motivating force. And the men who had been fighting the Japanese were now fighting for themselves. And they demanded a political voice and a share of the land for which they had fought. And Magsaysay, a former guerrilla himself, was clever enough to see what was required and influential enough to get it. And when he took office in 1950, the Hawks, dominating central Luzon and much of Mindanao, the second largest island in the chain, commanded some 12,000 armed guerrillas and had the active cooperation of an estimated 1 million Filipinos and a nation of 17 million. And an army of 30,000 soldiers was helpless to contain them. The stockpiles of weapons captured from the Japanese or supplied during the war by the United States would have been sufficient to keep a civil war in progress for decades, and the bulk of the population, if not actively sympathetic to the insurgents, was at least passive. The terrain, mountains, and swampy jungle favored the guerrillas. The troops, hated by the villagers, were confined to the larger centers of the population and were seldom seen in the back country except on sporadic punitive expeditions, and then only in full force, an invading army arriving in trucks and armored vehicles to terrorize the rural population. So, it kind of setting the stage of what's to come. Now, we know what the outcome is, because in the past, we've studied pretty extensively about Magsaysay, and at that time, it was Colonel Lansdale. He went on to retire later as a two-star, a major general in the United States Air Force. Has a long history, and this today is not a lesson on Major General Lansdale, but it's the point is of where we're going here as to where, why is it that some insurgencies are successful and some are not? What made the American Revolution successful? Now, we've pointed out also in our opening lesson on insurgency that the insurgency is neither a revolution or a civil war, but when it's conducted properly, can ignite either a civil war or a revolution. So we have all the components that the leading up to the events that really spiraled out of control for the British in April 19th of Lexington and Concord. But there certainly was a lot of groundwork by the political subversives, the guerrillas, and the terrorists, or we'd call them terrorists today. If you dress up like Indians and go into Boston Harbor and throw the cargo overboard, that I'm sure that you would be called a terrorist today. So we could call it the Boston Tea Party and call them rebels. Rebels been rebels since I don't know when. But that's the story. So now we're kind of laying out the understanding of the parts that Magsaysay had. Now, we've covered that before in a multi-part case study. And right now, I see we've got about 11 minutes or so until the top of the hour. So I just kind of wanted to set the stage for next Monday's broadcast, and we'll continue with what happened and how because of the corruption in the political arm in the Philippines, that it was pretty corrupt before World War II, and then the Japanese came along, and the people were pretty much willing to support the guerrillas to fight the Japanese. But then after the war, the people that had been in power, they just assumed that it was going to transition back to them. And the people said no. And when the people, the corrupt politicians and the military, tried to force it on the people said even louder, no. And so the people really hated the military in their heavy-handedness, but it was so brilliant what Colonel Lansdale and Ramon Magsaysay did on how they turned the people's hatred towards the military into accepting them and then embracing them. It's a classic example of insurgency. Now, as usual, I'll point out that I don't particularly care for the term counterinsurgency. We've covered that also by Sir Robert Thompson, because it conjures up that you're waiting for the insurgents to act before the government security forces will react, but you actually have to get out ahead of the insurgents to effectively battle the insurgents. But since the term counterinsurgency, or the acronym COIN, is utilized and it's so universal, sometimes I'll say it because it's an accepted term, kind of like the term sunrise and sunset, because here on planet Earth, it appears that the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, but actually the sun kind of sets in one place, and the Earth is actually turning, rotating, and it gives the illusion that there is a sunrise and a sunset, just like it's an illusion about counterinsurgency operations. But that's just my opinion and a few other. But anyway, your mind is your primary weapon. Today is the 20th of August, 2018. You're tuned into Liberty Tree Radio. I hope that you help Liberty Tree Radio stay on the air. When you send in your contribution, because freedom isn't free and liberty isn't free, there is a price to pay for it, that when you send it in, if you find certain broadcasts here on Liberty Tree Radio, whether it's Pastor Brooks in the Liberty Bible Hour, or Mark and Don with the Intel Report, or Craig with Forbidden Knowledge, or Your Mind is Your Primary Weapon with Mike in Arizona Land, if you find some of those beneficial, it helps in the feedback loop that in addition to your contribution for Liberty Tree Radio, include a note in there and express what parts that you like better, why I tune in to Liberty Tree Radio, because we all know that there's multiple other broadcast networks, broadcast stations, broadcast hosts, and so if you can help the runners of Liberty Tree Radio with a little bit of feedback loop, then it would be beneficial of the whole bigger picture. Now, one of the things that we've been covering fairly extensively here since, April or May, is the problem, the riots, the killings, the paramilitary police forces, and who's behind it down in Nicaragua. Now, this first one is from insidecrime.org, and it's dated 25 July 2018. It's Nicaraguan anti-terrorism law could criminalize opposition. Lawmakers in Nicaragua recently approved an anti-terrorism law that many fear will be used to criminalize the opposition aimed at deepening political crisis, a tactic that has been used in other governments throughout the region for political ends. On July 16th, lawmakers in Nicaragua approved an anti-terrorism law against money laundering, financing terrorism and the proliferations of weapons of mass destruction, according to a government press release. The law was presented to Nicaraguan National Assembly in April, where the governing Sandinista National Liberation Front, the Frente Sandinista de Liberación Nacional, FSLN, holds the majority, according to El Nuevo Diario. It was approved amid a political crisis that is growing worse every day. Anyone who kills or injures somebody not directly participating in a situation of armed conflict, or who destroys or damages public or private property, can be sentenced up to 20 years in prison, according to the new legislation. Anyone found guilty of directly or indirectly financing or aiding so-called terrorist operations can also face up to 20 years in prison. FSLN Deputy Wal Mauro Gutierrez described the law as something that will provide the government with the necessary and sufficient tools needed to effectively combat money laundering, criminal crime, organized crime, terrorism, and drug trafficking. But international observers such as the United Nations and the opposing politicians fear that the new law will be used by President Daniel Ortega to criminalize protesters and place them in prison. There are also concerns that it may be used to target members of non-governmental organizations in the church which have defended the anti-government protesters. Since anti-government protest began in April, human rights organizations have reported more than 350 deaths and over 2,000 injuries. The vast majority of the violence has been ordered by Ortega himself and carried out by pro-government paramilitary groups working in conjunction with the national police. The creation and the use of anti-terrorism laws directed at the members of the opposition or criminal organizations is a tactic that has been employed by other governments throughout the region. Lawmakers in El Salvador, for example, classified the country's violent gangs as terrorist organizations through the 2016 legislative reform as the government doubled down on hardline security measures to combat rising violence connected to the gangs. However, the move was arguably had the opposite impact to that intended. Gangs and their criminal activities have grown more sophisticated in response to these measures, and El Salvador is still one of the region's most violent countries. Yep. Borderlandbeat.com, 11 August 2018, seized 92 pounds of heroin from 81-year-old woman at Tecate Port of Entry, San Diego. U.S. Customs and Border Protection officers at the Tecate Port of Entry Wednesday seized 92 pounds of heroin valued at more than $870,000 from an elderly woman. The 81-year-old woman had heroin hidden inside of her car. The cartels will try and manipulate anyone to smuggle their narcotics through the ports of entry, said San Diego CBP Director of Field Operations Peter Flores. CBP officers are aware of the many tactics used by the cartels and remain ever vigilant to stop anyone attempting to smuggle narcotics. CBP officers working at the Tecate border crossing encountered an 81-year-old woman, United States citizen, when she entered the U.S. driving a 2011 Chrysler 200 at about 11:30 a.m. A CBP K-9 team was screening vehicles as they waited in line for inspection, where the detector dog alerted to the driver side rocker panel. CBP officers referred the vehicle for more in-depth inspection, during which CBP officers discovered and extracted a total of 34 wrapped packages of heroin from the vehicle's rocker panel. The estimated street value of the heroin is over $870,000. See, we're right up the top. I wonder if we'll get to go out with Lou Reed heroin. Maybe we'll get one more in here. I'll try. Borderlandbeat.com, August 11, 2018. Guanajuato, man attacked by armed men, is followed to hospital and killed while state police are on guard for another victim. four men attacked and killed a wounded man last night who was receiving medical attention at the General Hospital in Panahamo. The armed men confronted municipal and state police who were guarding the hospital, leaving one person dead and three injured. The fatal victim is a man nicknamed El Pingo, who was first shot in Colonia Beltran when he arrived at his home. The wounded man went to his vehicle together with his wife and two children, age 14 and 16 respectively, to the general hospital to receive medical help. However, when he reached the emergency room, he was attacked for the second time outside of the facility by four men who were riding on two motorcycles. The shooting alerted municipal and state police who were guarding the hospital because there was a patient in the hospital who was a gunshot victim in the confrontation between criminal groups that occurred on Thursday at midnight in the El Suez del Viraflor community, where left three men dead. After finishing El Pingo, the four alleged assassins attacked the policemen who were demanding that they throw down their weapons. The shooting spread panic amongst patients and medical personnel who were in the emergency area. The criminals managed to escape on board the motorcycles. And that's what's going on in Mexico and Nicaragua and El Salvador. Well, it sounds like we're going out with some root heroin, and you wonder why I play this song. Thanks for listening. I'll see you on Thursday over on the Micro Effect, a rainy interview. Thanks for listening today and sending this one out to Lily, Grace, Antoinette, and Lou Reed.
Just where I'm going.